I'm going to start this series on the hindrances. I believe you've had, those of you who've been coming to this class have heard recently talks on the foundations of mindfulness, of the body, breathing, emotions. Am I on the right track here? Also, a talk or so on the Four Noble Truths. Is that also true? The hindrances are defined by the Buddha as the five coverings that hinder understanding. Coverings, I suppose, like a tarp over an old car or... And understanding, what understanding is he referring to? In order to answer that, I'd like to give a, before I get to the hindrances themselves, I'd like to talk, give a brief overview of what the hindrances are keeping us from seeing. I think most of us would agree that that the kind of reality that we construct for ourselves as we grow up is that we are a person with a rather constant identity in a hopefully constant, unchanging body, which we notice isn't true, but we reluctantly notice that. We have a pretty strong sense of who we are and what this world is like around us. As we grow older, we learn more and more about it. And we learn how to function in it. And we see it as a relatively permanent establishment, this world around us. And we believe that if we can really do it right, we'll be able to pass through this life with relatively little discomfort. In fact, we put a lot of our attention on trying to minimize that discomfort. We don't like it. We think it's an unnecessary and somehow it's a failure on our part that we are experiencing discomfort. What the Buddha is saying, on the other hand, is that the three fundamental characteristics of reality are that this world is impermanent. There is nothing about it that is not changing. And because it is impermanent, and we are yoked with this human idea of what we want and how we want to keep it forever, suffering is inevitable. It's an inevitable result of being a human being. And because this world is impermanent, there's really no such thing as a self because it's changing all of the time. And so there's really nothing to say about yourself that won't be different in a few moments. But we resist that. In his coming to understanding, impermanence was the first insight that he had, and what I was referring to in my instructions during the sitting was it's the opportunity to watch yourself just in this simple practice and see how rapidly all of your sensations are changing during each breath. Each breath is different from the last breath, is different from the one coming later. Each emotion arises and passes away. Each thought arises and passes away. We sit here with this idea that we are this person sitting here doing this thing, and yet actually everything that's going on in our minds and in our bodies in this half an hour is constantly changing. And we are so resistive to accepting that as reality. But this practice is the one opportunity that we have to actually begin to really get that. And the Buddha is saying that until you get that, you are going to suffer. That's the deal. So this sitting practice, which is a very simple thing, isn't it? Not easy, but simple, has possible very profound outcomes. We often get into it as a way of reducing the stress in our lives, trying to get our heads straight, and it's very good for that. But along comes a rather subversive package, usually unlabeled. And as I believe in truth in labeling, I have to say, you know, you do this at your own peril. There are three unwholesome roots. We love numbers. Those are, as we all know, greed, aversion, and delusion. Delusion is always named last, but it's actually the prime mover of the three. Delusion is the inability to see that the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and non-self, are actually true. And because we cannot see those, we are naturally thrown into states of greed and aversion, wanting desperately the things that we can't have, and wanting desperately to be separated from the things that we do have. And then once we're thrown into that state of greed and aversion, it's pretty hard not to just keep on being deluded, because we can't really quiet our mind and be able to see what's really happening if we're caught up in greed and aversion. So there's a nasty little cycle here. And so the three unwholesome roots, greed, aversion, and delusion, the Buddha started out all of his teaching by starting with the Four Noble Truths, where the presentation of his total package was simplified down to what can we do to end suffering? What is a prescription for suffering, and how can we alleviate the suffering? So for those of you who don't know the Four Noble Truths, they're very simply that life is inevitably composed, at least in part, of suffering. The cause of suffering is that, the second truth, the cause of suffering is that we are relating to our life experience through either greed or aversion. So we have a very strong emotional desire to have more of it or have less of it. And the way to stop the suffering is to stop the greed and aversion. And the way to do that is the Eightfold Path. Right livelihood, right intention, right understanding, which can be summarized as mindfulness practice, as supported by a life of morality and a life of generosity, which opens up the spirit and the mind in a quiet way to being able to do mindfulness practice. So that's the whole package in a nutshell, except for these hindrances, which keep obscuring our understanding. And so now I can talk about what I came to talk about. So all we have to do now is do this mindfulness practice with serious intention, do it as often as we can, do it with the idea that we're not just going to do it for the few minutes that we're sitting down each day that we have time, but we're also going to try to carry that into our whole life, so we're always aware as much as we can be of what is going on in our lives inside of us, what our emotional life, mental life, physical life is like, how they're all interrelated, how they give us a lot of insight into what's driving us, what's skillful and what's unskillful, so that we're constantly trying to raise our attention level about what it is that's actually going on. And in doing that, we begin to get glimpses of how rapidly things are changing and how suffering is coming up in virtually every thought we have in our minds in some form or another, wanting something to go away, wanting more of something, wanting something to happen sooner, wanting somebody else to stop doing what they're doing. All of those things, constantly, watch your mind. It's thousands, millions of times a day these thoughts are coming up, and we're quite enchanted with them. A lot of interesting activity in there. The mindfulness practice is to not only be able to see what's happening, but to be able to accept what's happening. So it has two elements to it: clear seeing and an unjudging acceptance. No guilt, no self-criticism, just this is what's happening right now. The hindrances are the things that are particularly active in our lives to keep us from doing this. And there are five of them. I'm only going to talk about the first one tonight. You'll hear about the others in the next 4 weeks. But the five are, first of all, sensual desire, which I will go into in more detail. The second, sensual desire has clearly got the energy of wanting. The second hindrance is aversion and ill will. Clearly has the energy of not wanting, not liking. The next three are, and it's easy to see how both the wanting and the not wanting, they get the mind stirred up, and we'll talk about that. The others are various variations on this. One of them is simply sleepiness. One of the real hindrances is sleepiness, laziness, dullness, referred to as typically as sloth torpor. Just can't muster the mental energy to be paying attention. Just rather nod off. The opposite of that is restlessness, agitation. There's just so much energy that you can't quiet down enough to pay attention, often fed by things like remorse and guilt. And the last is doubt. Doubt that this effort is worth doing. Kind of spiritual doubt, as opposed to self-criticism. Just doubt of what this practice can do for you. So those will each be talked about in turn, but tonight I'd just like to focus on my favorite one, which is sensual desire. This is, sensual desire is all forms. It has in that phrase a certain erotic connotation, which is definitely part of it, but it refers to all of the gratifications of all of the senses, all of the five senses: touch, feel, hearing, seeing, tasting, and the emotional, mental sense, as referred to in Buddhism. So anything that is pleasing to the emotions, pleasing to the mind, an interesting thought, for example, an erotic fantasy, a fond memory, all of those things are covered under this phrase, sensual desire. And it very clearly has this energy of wanting more. And it's coming out of a dissatisfaction with how it is right now. Things aren't good enough the way they are. We want more. We at least want more entertainment in our minds. Maybe run some home movies, some old memories. Maybe think about some old friends, whatever. There is that restlessness in us, that dissatisfaction that feeds this sensual desire as a condition of being alive. So it's not like this is bad or this is somehow it's your fault that you've got this. This is the deal. Nothing to feel bad about. But you can be skillfully able to minimize or eliminate its damage if you are so motivated. I thought it might be fun to have some people name their favorites. Anybody got a particular place that their mind likes to go that they can tell us about without embarrassing themselves? I see a lot of self-conscious grinning here.
Here with these lilies, the smell is quite delicious.
Okay, good smell. Good smells. Yes?
I tend to get delusional and get caught in all this metaphysics stuff and create a cosmogony. So I need to come back to Earth or the Buddha and get grounded. That's why I'm coming here to get more pragmatic.
So you've decided, rather than just to change things a little bit, you've decided to leave altogether. Yes.
Food.
Food. You bet.
Salty, sweet.
Anybody here not like food? Not like maybe a little more food than they need just to eat, to be nourished? Food's a good one. It's got smell, it's got visual colors, tastes, even has texture. Yes.
I go windsurfing about twice a week.
Pardon me?
I go windsurfing. Twice a week. Worked in the garage for years.
Fantasy. Is that what you're saying? Well, as we get older, I've noticed that about myself. I do a lot of things now in my mind that I used to be able to do in my body. How about the multi sense inputs, like making love or being in love or skydiving or anyway, you can get the picture. This we each have the experience in one of these things that particularly hooks us, where our whole energy is put into that activity. And the idea of being mindfulness never even comes up as a concept. It's like it's almost impossible to bring it up because of the level of mental agitation that's going on, or mental deliciousness, or whatever, however we're relating to this activity. And it's addictive. It's addictive because it's so pleasant. And it's a diversion from the ordinariness of our lives most of the time. And this kind of reward frustration system is built in at a pretty early age. I mean, you know, we start out just wanting our mother's breast and wanting our mother's touch, and it just goes on from there. So by the time we're even 1 year old, we're pretty well set. In terms of our conditioning, it's, you know, we can talk about past lifetimes, but heaven knows there's enough going on in my first year of life to get pretty hooked. So, how do we get out of this? It's not to say that pleasure is bad. Or that it's unnatural, or as the Calvinists like to say, you know, it's between us and God. It stands between us and God. It's that pleasure, if not taken in a moderate way, can run our lives, either the consumption of it or the absence of it can run our lives. And the the prescription for working our way out of this is not to try and repress that arising of pleasure, which will obviously create then its own energy. We know what happens with, most of us know, have had some experience with what happens with repression. The recidivism rate off of going on diets is about 100%, I think, in this culture. So that repression thing doesn't work. Doesn't work for addictions either. Mindfulness is really what the Buddha is pointing to as the only possibility. He's not pointing to psychotherapy. He's pointing to mindfulness. Because mindfulness is the only way that we can develop enough awareness to see on a continuing basis how this stuff arises, how it passes away, how it arises again, how it passes away again, how it just keeps on keeping on, and that if we allow ourselves to get caught in that, it's just going to be the rest of our lives just following that. And each time that we do it, there's a phrase I love in Buddhism called, you know, conditioning rebirth. Every time we invest in that particular desire, that desire will come up that much more quickly the next time. We've all had this experience. And so we are, by following these desires, we're cultivating a climate or a field or a garden where this stuff is just growing faster and faster. And the only way to get ourselves at ease around it is to be aware, to see it coming up, and to just watch it. And in this regard, one of the powerful things about this full, the mindfulness of not only the breathing, but also of the body and the mind and the emotions, that you, if you're able to start to keep track of all of that, you start to see these urges coming up fairly early. You know, they're not fully, they don't have a lot of momentum going yet, and you start to see them, and you see the emotional and mental relationship and climate, and then you see what's going on in the body around it. And I promise you that with these kinds of repetitive relationships with our particular pleasures, there will be bodily sensations around it. We know about these. When we have memories of our favorite stuff, our whole body is participating in the memory, not just our mind. I mean, fantasies are every bit as powerful in the body as the real thing. You can go sit on retreat and have fantastic sexual experiences. You know, they just want, and you're just doing it all there in your head, but your body's doing it too. But if you catch yourself and you watch your body instead of your mind, because your mind is just going to keep on feeding it, if you get mindful about what's going on in the body and just watch it, it will pass away. And in the passing away, there's an incremental deconditioning of the arising of that particular relationship that you have with that hindrance. And each time that you're able to do that, it'll be deconditioned more. And you can actually experience the no longer arising of that particular hindrance. Not for the rest of your life, but for a significant period of time. I've actually gone on a fairly long retreat and had one of my favorite sensual desire hindrances go away for the entire month of the retreat after the first week of wrestling with it. So there's possibility of substantial relief. And as you get that relief, your mind quiets down and you start to see more and more clearly what is actually going on, and you start to have the possibility of actually really seeing in a clear, intuitive way these three characteristics, the things that are really underlying all of the made-up reality that we live with: impermanence, inevitable suffering, and self, non-self. So the really nice thing about this is that you don't have to get the whole thing completely eliminated in order to have any experience of this. It's not like you have to do all of the work to be enlightened, and then, you know, bingo, suddenly you start to have some reward after a lifetime or maybe 20 lifetimes of trying to work this out. Because the Buddha says something which I have found to be very important and true and very motivating. He used the phrase that the path is beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. And I find that to be very encouraging. So thank you. I'm open to any questions.
Something just came to my mind. This is a liberated view. Inferno, Dante Alighieri, there is a scene where Virgil and, it's going through. He's like the guide to Alighieri. And when the monster and the demons try to get the attention of Alighieri, Virgil says, just observe and it shall pass. Just observe. I think that's when Dante wrote that, must have some concepts of the book, which we were just talking about, just came to my mind when you said that. But when you observe something, you will eventually go away. Just observe without any judgment. Am I interpreted correctly?
Well, I can't speak for Dante, but there are certainly, you know, many, many instances in Western writing where this kind of understanding comes, not direct, from any direct exposure to Buddhism.
Can I think for a moment about Eliot? Something about the story about the bird. If you try to resist, you will smother it, and you have to let it go free. But you can observe it like you're just like a, without judgment, enjoying the presence of the bird. But then you cannot try to cage it or something by Eliot. What you were saying, some other instances in Western literary history, they're referring to the Buddha.
No, it's I think to me the thing that's a little bit it's very subtle about this is that I think we all intellectually understand that impermanence is the law of the day, but intellectually understanding it and viscerally understanding it are two different things. We also intellectually understand that we're going to die sometime. But as Woody Allen said, I don't want to be there when it happens, you know. And if I have anything to say about it, I won't be there. We just really, we're told it's going to happen, and we can appreciate that. But it's really not going to happen to me. Just the rest of you. Don't we all, at some level, have that kind of belief system operating? I mean, it's really hard to really take it in that our life is going to be limited in its duration and that we have no control over how long that is. It's really hard to really get that. And I think in the same way, it's really hard to get... I mean, what the Buddha is saying is if you really get impermanence, you will deconstruct all of this other stuff on the spot. I mean, basically, the story of his enlightenment is he got the impermanence thing and all the rest of it just opened up to him because it was a natural outgrowth of impermanence. And they say in Buddhism that full enlightenment can come through any one of the three characteristics. If you fully get any one of the three, impermanence or suffering or non-self, that's sufficient to get the other two.
I'm still experimenting with the comments. And for instance, when Nikos came in and we were meditating, you suggested that we keep an open mind, be excited and feel every sensation that happens. And as I kept watching what was happening, there are a myriad of sensations taking place. And the awareness hits on any one and then moves to another, depending on the mind and the quality of the mind. I still believe that something, whatever's happening doesn't stop just because we're not focused on it. It's still happening. So it's still happening temporarily. And basically, it has to go to a conclusion, and then it transforms into something else or dies away. So to that extent, it's impermanent. But I'm trying to figure out if everything is impermanent. Some things have a beginning, an end, and a new beginning. So is that impermanence, or is it a step in impermanence?
Well, what I was trying to do in this instruction is not... I was not trying to imply that all I had to do was say those words and you would now be able to do what I had suggested. This is what I was trying to instead do was describe the direction that your practice can move in so that as you get more accomplished in watching your breath and expanding that into watching what's going on in your body and in your emotional life, you will begin to track a lot of this material simultaneously when it's important, not when it's unimportant. Because you don't have to keep track of everything. If you're keeping track of just the things that are easily seen, you will begin to see that their nature, which is that they're constantly changing. And as your concentration gets deeper, what tends to happen is you do get to, your view of all of these experiences is broadening. So you're taking in more, but also what you're beginning to recognize as your concentration deepens is how much more quickly they're changing than you ever realized. And it gets to a point where literally there isn't anything that's in existence long enough to even give it a name. I'll give you an example. One of the Burmese techniques is to try and label the thing that you're observing in your experience. So if you have a pain, let's say you have a pain in your knee, and you try and label it in terms of its quality. Is it stabbing? Is it hot? Is it searing? No complicated stuff. Not this is my ligament and it's attached to my elbow. And, you know, it's just about what is the bare sensation that you're observing, and where is it. And if you enter into that kind of an activity, and this pain in your knee, which feels like it's there like for the whole sitting, it's never going to go away, and it's constant, and it's in this place. If you really start watching it closely, I promise you, you will see that its quality is changing so fast that you cannot make up words fast enough to keep up with the rapid change of the quality of the sensation or the location of the sensation. It is not in one place. Our mind constructs a concept of permanence and applies it to that sensation. It is completely made up in our heads. It has nothing to do with actually what's going on in our body. And as you start to really home in on these things, and this noting practice is very helpful in this, you start to realize how we have created this illusion in our mind of you know, our whole reality. And it's very misinformed. And interestingly enough, it's a very widely held illusion. We can agree on a lot of these things, but then also people that have been doing this practice can agree that it's not true. So you have a choice. I think what happens, you know, if you have an experience of this kind of thing in any area, example of pain is one, you can pick anything. As soon as you've had that example, you get a peek into the realization that your mind has got an enormous number of projections that it's projecting onto its external world and making up reality. And that's just one example. But every time you get a new example, this constructed reality that we have begins to break down. And this sitting practice is a long, slow process of incrementally just chipping away at this thing until you have sufficiently deconstructed it to really start to viscerally embrace the characteristics that the Buddha is pointing to. So it's not a sudden, you know, there it is, and I see it all. Although there are lots of stories in Buddhist history about people that did that, you know, those are inspiring stories. I don't know anyone myself that's had that experience. But maybe, you know, I'm not denying those stories. I'm just saying most of us kind of do it chip by chip. Yes.
Observing a hindrance or something like that and feeling a need to control it or whatever it is. Would you say that comes from aversion or basically, you know, trying to sort of understand where that's coming from?
Well, some things we'd like to control because we want them to stay around. If they're good, we'd like them not to change. And we'd like to be able to control that if we could. If you have a relationship that's good, you don't want it to change. You want it to stay exactly the same. But we all know that hasn't worked out so far. But we tend to keep on trying. And in the same, I think, in the same way, if it's an unpleasant thing, your control effort is to keep it away from you. So I think the control thing can be driven by, well, first of all, the main thing is it's driven by delusion. The delusion that somehow you can intervene and reconstruct fundamental reality so that it won't change. So that it won't change and it'll never come near you, or it won't change and it'll never go away from you. So that's delusion. And the delusion allows the existence of either greed or aversion. Because if you really got it, that you couldn't do that, you, you would also get it that there's no point in investing in the greed or the aversion. That it's a completely unsatisfactory investment. So as in those three unwholesome roots, the delusion then creates an environment where the other two can prosper.
There's also another aspect, perhaps, of that, and that's that you get the delusion that there is an agent me, that somehow at the center of it is solid, which could have control over something else. So it sort of strengthens that part of the delusion as well.
Certainly, yes. You're right. You're absolutely right about that. Lying underneath this wanting something to go away or wanting something to stay, it's I that is wanting that, and I have a right to it. Have it my way, and I will be able to get it my way if I'm clever enough or determined enough or whatever. And in terms of when you brush your teeth, yeah, you can have that. You know. Yes?
Well, it's interesting what you say. I think there are dualities that I'm experiencing listening to. For example, I think people need to understand norms that regulate behavior in order to survive in society, to belong, to be part of a group, to comply with conditions, which in a way are in conflict with freedom to be responding to what is, to respond to what's present. Because every one of these things that you need to survive also does your inner survival in. They just exist in the duality.
Well, the Buddha is pointing to that in this idea in the Eightfold Path. He has, in that part of the Eightfold Path, which is about right behavior, that is acknowledging that we are in a social fabric, and if we do things to rend that fabric, we will be so mentally agitated that we can't be mindful. So he's acknowledging that there is this level of relative reality where we are in the world. It's a world that we all can relatively agree on the description of it. And that world, we have to be able to function in that world. We have to be able, we find it's highly convenient to say, I'm going to the store. You know, there's this, it's very linguistically convenient to say that. There's this thing that's going to go down to that thing, but that thing down there is not a store. It's a random collection of atoms and molecules, and you know, but it's still, you know, so it's it, so we have to be able to function in that reality, and at the same time, these characteristics are pointing to a more ultimate reality, and if one can understand that, The suffering that we have, the thing that's driving this, we're talking about mental suffering here. I mean, we're going to have physical suffering just by nature of being human beings alive in the world. We're going to get old and we're going to get sick and we're going to die. That kind of suffering is not optional. He's talking about optional suffering. He's talking about the stuff that's going on in our heads because we've got this erroneous view of what the real ultimate reality is. This such things as permanence.
Well, it's the thing. I mean, I think we create mental models of how reality ought to be to help us function in those mental models. And when reality is different than those mental models, we suffer. And the problem is, that's what I mean by duality. The models serve us, but they do us in at the same time.
Sure, we come to believe them.
Right.
Surrender. So surrender is not, that's why it's so important to serve and stay away both from the I, which precedes the wanting or the aversion. But this is a common attribute, common error, is to go into the surrender.
Yeah, I mean that's. I agree. That's. I mean the non-self idea. It does not suggest that in the end, you just get totally passive and don't be active. I mean, in order to be on this path, you have to be active. You have to actually have the intention to practice. You have the intention to lead a skillful life. It takes a lot of active critical evaluation of the situation and so on. And so the answer is not to just say, well, I'm not here, so it doesn't matter. That's erroneous conclusion. What it's saying, what the non-self idea is saying is not that there isn't anything. It's that the concept that we have about self is not correct. It's not that there isn't anything here. It's just that our concept isn't it's misleading to us. You know, this is me, this is my body. I actually have absolutely no control over this body. It's going to die whenever it gets ready to. I cannot make that change. I cannot even cure myself of a cold or decide when I'm going to get one. This is my body, but it's not my body. So he's just pointing to the idea that there is this, that there's another way of holding this sense of self, which is not, doesn't have such strict definitions to it. Yes?
I like when you use the word deconditioning, right? You become mindful of a pattern that arises and then you don't act. I think I've read that a lot in Buddhist studies that some specific thing. Anybody who ever quit smoking knows that process intimately, deconditioning. You have a desire for a cigarette, but you make the choice not to have it. You watch the desire, you watch it rise, and watch it go away. Somebody told me when I quit smoking that desire for the cigarette will go away in the same amount of time that it takes to smoke one. So either way, when you get to the end of that period of time, you no longer desire the cigarette, and it's your choice in between whether to smoke or not. It helped me quit a lot. It's sometimes on the larger sphere of things that and I think this has to do with definitions of self, it's like almost needing a global deconditioning. And by this I mean, like, you wake up, you are a person that owns things, that has bills, that has a job, you have a profession, and you're defined by your relationships with other people that are really enmeshing. You know, you love this person, you have this child, these things are and it's harder to, I mean, is it, you know, sometimes harder to think of deconditioning each one of those things as it arises. Okay, well, now I'm thinking about this relationship with my son, and now I'm not going to react in this way, or I'm not going to get anxious about a mortgage or the possibility of not having my job. But those things, or if you lose somebody you love, and those things become so overwhelming, pervasive, that it's almost, you don't have a chance to be mindful. I find that a great challenge to wake up and I go, well, who am I? I mean, it's the same thing when I look at other people. When you said that you taught meditation to prisoners in Soledad, and that creates, you know, there's your identity there. That's a big, huge thing for me. And I go, well, perhaps I should be somebody who teaches meditation to prisoners. What a magnificent thing to be. I don't know what the question is and all that. Sometimes I don't know, people advise retreat for that global deconditioning where you could step out of those relationships, step out of that job identity, because I find that all that stuff so consuming. I feel like I don't have a chance against it sometimes.
Well, let me start with the example of me being a person who teaches at Soledad Prison. I know that when you hear that, you've got a story about me now. And I'm sure everyone else in the room has a story about me. Probably none of the stories are the same. And probably none of the stories would match the story that I would tell. But that's just one of the things that our mind does. It makes up stories about other people and about ourselves. And it's the stories about ourselves that we're pointing to in this non-self thing. In Zen Buddhism, they use this active questioning idea, right? You know, I'm sitting here with my eyes closed. Who's this person that's sitting here? Who is this person that's sitting here? And you start to try to answer it, and you keep on asking the question, and you kind of break through a whole bunch of levels of assumptions, and the more you do that, the less there is of an answer. And that's not to deny the reality of the fact that you have a son and you care about him, or that you have a job that you need because you need to eat. It's just about what it's pointing to is that those things don't identify who you are. They're just part of your participation in this web of life. And they're very real. It's not to diminish them at all. But it doesn't have to have a name put on them. It doesn't have to be some sort of, you know, really rock-solid person to have all of those relationships. It can be a non-person. Still have the relationships. What's interesting is that we seem to develop this very deep need to define ourselves in these terms. And if you really look closely at what's driving that need and what part it plays in your life, it doesn't turn out to be very substantial. But you can spend a lot of your time protecting that thing you've constructed for yourself. You know, I mean, there are millions of examples of this. Will my neighbors think less of me if I don't have a new car or a new house? Or, you know, will my neighbors think less of me if I don't have the right kind of job? I mean, that's all BS, you know. It's really BS when the rubber hits the road. But if we don't look at those things closely, we can spend our whole life chasing ghosts. And that's what this is pointing to, is, you know, don't take yourself too seriously, the self that you've constructed. Nobody else is even noticing. Except your loved ones, of course. But they'll forgive you. Yes?
So some of the stuff we've talked about is like a way of approach to, you know, escaping the desire is essentially by deconstructing everything. And I guess I suggest that sounds like a really hard approach to apply all the time. And I guess I've read a sort of a simpler approach, which is to, you know, if you desire something, you can look at aspects of that thing that are less desirable as a way to create that attachment. And
yes,
it's maybe a little bit simpler than trying to deconstruct yourself or deconstruct that thing, although maybe that's the ultimate goal, but, you know, I just thought I'd see if that's that.
Well, certainly, you know, if you're overcome by an urge to buy a new car, you can ask yourself the question of, well, what is that thing that I want to buy, and how long will it be new, and how long will my satisfaction with owning it last? Even that, you know, will it last until I get out of the lot? I mean, you know, you can begin to ask yourself those questions and give honest answers to them, and you can diffuse a lot of kind of empty desire in that way. To me, one of the most profound things about all of this kind of deconstruction is that I think that there's a general tendency to ascribe a sort of nihilism to it. That, you know, if when you take away all of this stuff, you have nothing left. And that's a pretty desperate state. And that isn't what happens. You know, that's the most astonishing thing about it, is what happens as you start to deconstruct this stuff is that all of that mental capacity that was allocated to those things goes to love and compassion. So there's a natural mental human condition that when unfettered by all of this garbage, what arises are love and compassion and a great deal of caring for fellow human beings and a great deal of identification with them in terms of recognizing their pain and wanting to serve them. So it's a very paradoxical kind of thing that when you take away these things that we tend to fill our lives up with, all of these little activities of some of which are essential. We have to be able to eat to stay alive, no question about it. We need shelter, but a lot of them are not essential. And to the extent that we can simplify our life and quiet our mind down and put our efforts on the things that count and not on the things that don't count, all of that extra mental energy becomes a very positive force in our lives. It doesn't go nihilistic on us. You can't predict that through any logical process. But that's the outcome. I mean, you see it over and over again. People go on long retreats. At the end of the retreat, people are filled up they've emptied out so much of their sense of self, and they're filled up instead with so much love and caring for other people. It's just a really remarkable process to watch over and over and over again. Whoever the people are, this is a universal characteristic. This is not special to any one person. In fact, none of this stuff is. That's another part. We think our own story is so important, and it's just us we're talking about. And yet everything the Buddha is pointing to here was true for every human being 2,500 years ago, and it's true for every human being now. Now, it's really hard to take that personally, if you really get that. That this life I'm leading is the only one I have, but it's not special. It's only special in terms of these little external characteristics that we want to put on them, like what my son's name is, or what my dog looks like, or all the unimportant things are the things that make us special. The important things make us all the same. Yes. It's very clear in the Buddha's teachings that enlightened people have all of the afflictive emotions arising. Grasping, ill will, they all come up. It's a nature of our mind, it's the nature of our conditioning as human beings. The enlightened person doesn't get attached, doesn't invest their emotional energy into believing that, into then going out and, you know, making it real. They just watch it arise and watch it pass through and go away again. But it's going to keep on coming even after you're enlightened. So don't expect it to go away once you've gotten it to go away the first time. That will not happen. And each of us, I think, we would find variations in the human condition in that some of us are predisposed to have aversive negative thoughts come up, for example, perhaps fearful ones. Some of us are predisposed to have greedy thoughts come up, controlling thoughts. We describe each other routinely in terms of personality characteristics. And if we really look at ourselves, we can see that if we have that characteristic, we do tend to have that particular mental formation coming up more often than the others. But they're all of the whole squadron of these things are all flying through us, some of them just more often than others. And over time, we will see they'll actually change. You know, maybe there'll be periods of your life that are more aversive, and then other periods that are more grasping, periods that are more restless. But the whole package is yours for your life. Not going to get rid of it. All you can do is change the way you relate to it each time it comes up. But in so doing that, each time you get caught less, and it makes it much easier to get even less caught the next time. So you are progressing along on each one of these hindrances, that it comes up perhaps less frequently, comes and you catch it quicker, and it doesn't stay around as long because you're not caught by it. Yes.
So I'm thinking we carry a lot of burden, maybe not all of us, and right now working with children, so I'm thinking we carry a lot of hurt from our childhood. And
you're thinking that we're carrying a lot of hurt from our childhood.
All of us. And the reason I say that is there's a lot of reason for it. Like, especially for the past couple of weeks that I've been working in a dental office and there's a lot of kids, I see how sensitive they are. I mean, sometimes we're trying to help them, but if we get, angry or whatever, I mean, it could be one snap, but they take it in, and they start crying. And as soon as you change your tone, you're like, okay, sorry, did I scare you, whatever, it goes away. And if you don't, you get more angry because you want them to do what you want them to do, because you think you're an adult and you know, it gets worse. So I'm thinking, we're all children at one point. And how much of that hurt are we carrying on? And how much of things we do, trying to learn, undo, meditate, and this and that. I mean, it's all good and everything, but it also is, I think, very good to remember back and to really get connected to when we were a kid.
I don't. I agree with you. We do acquire a lot of those hurts in childhood. We don't have to remember back. I could start yelling at anybody in this room and they'd start reacting. It's right there.
Yeah.
No matter how long ago that wound was initially inflicted, it's right there at the surface. People do not like to be yelled at, no matter how mature they are.
It's true.
And I think that's that vulnerability that we had as children carried forward. We haven't really developed, as long as we're caught in this idea that it's, that there's a me here that's being humiliated by this yelling, we're caught.
And then there's this other side to the kids that's very free and very joyous. And I think that's probably what we all want, it's nice to be there. And it doesn't need this or that,
Thank you all.